Good afternoon. You're listening to KGPR, Great Falls at 89.9 FM, Public Radio for North Central Montana. My name is Matt Donnelly, and I'm here in the studio today with music director and conductor of the Great Falls Symphony, Grant Harville.
Hi, Matt. How are
you doing? Welcome back, Grant.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
And as I recall, we have another concert under our belt.
Yeah. So a week from today, on November 6th, we'll be doing our second orchestra concert of the season. We're titling it String Theory. It features one of our own violinists, Megan Carls. She'll be playing the Prokofiev Violin Concerto No. 1, which is a personal favorite of hers, one that when we were talking about sort of pieces that she'd like to do, this was a sort of bucket list one for her. So, and it's one that I enjoy a lot, so I was happy to bring it in. And that's going to be the meat on this particular sandwich, which the bread is a couple of North German pieces, you might say.
Okay.
So their composers did wander away from their North German roots at various points, but they have some really interesting connections, which I think makes them a nice little pairing.
And what are the bread that we're talking about with these composers?
Yeah, well, so our first piece on the program, we're opening with a piece by Felix Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn, born in Hamburg, but raised in Berlin. And his father was a banker, sort of absurdly rich guy.
Ooh.
And so Mendelssohn had sort of all of the sort of privileges of a rich upbringing, the best education money could buy, sort of private lessons on everything, and a really talented kid, a really good artist, a visual artist, and really great musician growing up, a sort of prodigious talent.
Mm.
And the ability to take some fun vacations if they needed to do that. So he and his father at one point took a trip to a place called Bad Doberan, which is on the Baltic coast, sort of the North German coast, and it's sort of a resort town. It's a place where politicians will get together and have summits and things like that to this day.
Mm-mm.
And while he was there, the Duke, he had this group of musicians that Mendelssohn heard play, and this kind of group is called a harmony, but it basically just means a small wind ensemble that the Duke gets to play for various occasions, usually outside.
Ooh.
And so Mendelssohn heard this as part of his vacation, as 15 or so at the time, and was sort of caught up by the sound of it and wrote a piece for this kind of ensemble. And he called the piece Nocturne, which is one of my favorite words in music because it essentially means nothing. it basically means music that's appropriate for being played in the evening, which could mean anything, right? It could mean a lullaby. It could mean wild party music. It could mean just about anything.
Or even a dirge or...
Yeah, anything.
Or even Halloween music since that's coming up.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's a... it's just, it can take any number of forms. And this particular Nocturne is actually a really kind of upbeat, fun, kind of sprightly little piece that has says a lot more about Mendelssohn, the 15-year-old, than, say, something that you think of as being sort of nighttime and gloomy.
Mm.
And so it's a really high-spirited work. And it's interesting, it's sort of rare because it's a piece for winds from an era where we don't have a lot of wind repertoire. So if you ever go to a lot of band concerts, the vast majority of the stuff that they play is written post-1900 or at least sort of Sousa and then later. Or they might do a few arrangements of things earlier than that. But to find music for wind instruments from earlier than that is pretty rare. And so this is just a small group. As I say, these harmonies were these small groups of wind players.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we're going to open this program, a sort of youthful piece by Mendelssohn for a group that kind of caught his attention when he was on vacation as a teenager.
And talking about the Nocturnes, I'm pretty sure Mendelssohn was probably influenced by Chopin, since Chopin was pretty big on the Nocturnes for piano, and of course John Field before Chopin.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know if the timeline quite works out exactly right. Mendelssohn and Chopin are basically the same era, so whether Chopin's music had made it over to northern Germany by the time Mendelssohn was 15. I'm not so sure. But he does have another piece called Nocturne, the one from Midsummer Night's Dream, which is very famous. And that one very much has a sort of stillness, sort of nighttime beauty to it. But again, that's the beauty of a nocturne. It can sort of do whatever you want it to do as long as... you know, as long as you can play it at about 8 o'clock at night, then you're doing just fine in terms of that particular genre. But.
And then feel that night mist, and even look up at the stars while it while the piece reminds you of what you're seeing.
Yeah, well, and you know, nocturne is a lot of ways the same word as a serenade. A serenade means music for evening, and you know, when you think about a serenade, you think of, you know, someone playing guitar while their love is on a balcony, that kind of thing, right? And and, you know, a piece like Eine kleine Nachtmusik by Mozart, which means a little serenade, a little music for the evening, is, you know, that's just party music. It's just music to be background for somebody's event, right? So I think in a lot of ways, this nocturne has that kind of spirit. It's less the twinkling of stars in the sky and more the, this is going to be a really good way to kick off your evening's entertainment.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. Here is the Nocturne for Wind Instruments by Felix Mendelssohn. Let's listen in.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is KGPR Great Falls at 89.9 FM. My name is Matt Donnelly, and I'm here in the studio today with Great Falls Symphony Music Director and Conductor Grant Harville. Welcome back, Grant.
Thank you, Matt.
And we were talking about Mendelssohn, but we also want to talk about the Johannes Brahms piece that's going to be part of the concert. That's the other bread of the sandwich.
Right, exactly. And, you know, what I love about sort of bringing Mendelssohn and Brahms into the same concert, sort of more generally, they're both born in Hamburg, but they had very different upbringings. Mendelssohn left Hamburg with his family, went to Berlin, and had this very privileged upbringing where he not only was really rich, but he was, you know, meeting people like Goethe and like the great poet and stuff like that. So very sort of cultured from a young age, great education, all of that. Brahms was born in Hamburg, as I say, but he didn't leave. He grew up there. And Hamburg is a very different kind of town than Berlin, certainly at the time. Berlin is the sort of seat of Prussian government. There's lots of power there. There's lots of sort of a more cosmopolitan city. Hamburg is cosmopolitan too, but in a different way. It's a blue-collar town. It's on the river leading up to the North Sea, so it's the place where all the sailors are coming down to sort of drop off whatever they're shipping into the sort of Central European area. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit of a rougher place. It's blue-collar, as I say. And that's the kind of environment that Brahms grew up in. His father was a local town musician who was apparently a really sort of good-natured dude, not a very ambitious guy in the sense that he felt like, you know, music was a great way to earn a living. It was a lot of fun. It gave you chances to go get beers after concerts and things like that. And in that sense, he was very proud of his son, but the idea that his son might want to become this sort of great composer wasn't exactly the sort of musical career that his father sort of understood musical careers to be. And so Brahms had a good education growing up. He had good teachers and things like that. And he did get a big break when he was around 20 years old, where a violinist came through town, and Brahms was a pianist. And the violinist asked him, "Hey, can you accompany me on my tour of sort of German-speaking regions of Europe?" And Brahms said, "Sure," and they went along on this tour, and that gave Brahms a chance to sort of run into some influential people. Mm-hmm. And most significantly, the Schumanns, Robert and Clara Schumann. And Robert really advocated for Brahms as sort of the next big thing in German music. But all that said, there's this kind of insecurity to Brahms that lasts his entire life. And he actually says at one point that that he sort of felt the deficiency of his education compared to Mendelssohn. Like, he actually compared his own education to Mendelssohn.
Okay. So I definitely see the connection there.
yeah. Like, he was sort of envious of the kind of education that Mendelssohn got as a young person. And so Brahms always felt as an adult that he was kind of making up for this kind of lost education. And so he, again, that's not entirely fair. There are some Brahms teachers when he was a kid who might object to that characterization. But his entire adult life, he basically studied. He kept studying as a kind of music student pretty much until the day he died. And so he would do little compositional exercises over coffee each morning and things like that. And he's one of the first composers to really obsess, that may be too strong a word, but really become interested and invested in what he considered to be old music from previous generations. That's not really a thing that happens prior to the sort of mid-1800s, early 1800s. You know, Beethoven and Mozart, they knew about Bach, and maybe they had a few scores lying around and things like that, but they weren't so much sort of reaching back constantly into that old repertoire to find influences and ideas. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to Brahms in particular, again, this is mid-1800s to late 1800s, you're getting more and more composers, and Brahms in particular, who are really looking back to these older composers for models to imitate. Ooh. And in Brahms, again, in particular, because, again, I think he feels this sense of needing to sort of justify what he does, of needing to feel like he's a good composer, you know. And so one thing you can say to make that happen is like, well, if Beethoven did it, and if I can bring that in, And if Beethoven's great, and if I do it and bring that in, then I will also be a great composer. You know, it's a way of, again, kind of justifying the compositional choices that you make. One amazing thing about Brahms, again, we don't need to pity him or anything like that. Brahms is one of the very, very, very few composers who never had to write on commission. He never took a commission. Nobody ever said, write this piece and I'll pay you money. He always got to choose the things that he wrote. So how did he make money? Well, he conducted choirs sometimes, and he had publishers that he worked with and things like that. And he would send those publishers things that he had written and say, hey, can you sell this? Hey, can you sell this? Do you have any use for this? That kind of thing. But he never had to say, you know, to some random whomever, yes, I will write this piece you asked me to write, and you pay me this amount of money. And the fascinating thing about that is of course, that, you know, he's, again, this very rare example of a composer where we can say, this is, in some way, at least to a certain degree, everything he wrote was something he wanted to write.
Okay.
And so there's that kind of, you really get to sense a sense of his personal style from this. There's, you know, there's no equivalent to something like Wellington's Victory by Beethoven, which was absolutely written for an occasion, you know, where most fans of Beethoven wish the piece didn't exist and things like that. I mean, you don't get that kind of thing. Or maybe more appropriately, you know, Beethoven wrote about 170 folk song arrangements for a publisher in Scotland. And sort of completely weird extra part of his repertoire that we don't think about much, but he spent a lot of time in writing these things. And Brahms certainly had to know what the market was in order to satisfy his publishers and things like that, but he never had sort of direct demands for works placed on him. So he got to choose the things that he wrote in a way that very few composers do. So to speak more specifically about this piece we're going to play, which is the Variations on a Theme of Haydn by Brahms. And it's a great piece. It's been one of my favorites for a very long time. And it's a piece that he wrote, again, because he wanted to. It's 1873 or so. And a friend of his, a kind of librarian historian friend of his, shows him music and more connections with Mendelssohn. This is music written for a harmony ensemble, written for winds, the same kind of ensemble that inspired Mendelssohn. Supposedly, this music is all by Haydn. So this librarian says, hey, Brahms, meet me at, you know, the Red Hedge Jog or wherever they met, and whatever the favorite bar was. And they and this librarian shows him these works, supposedly by Haydn, four winds, and Brahms looks them over and says, hey, neat, neat. And he finds a movement in one of them called the St. Anthony Chorale.
Oh, wow.
And he doesn't immediately act on this. This is a few years earlier, but the tune kind of stays with him. And there's, who knows what's actually going through Brahms's head at any given time, but somehow it stuck with him enough that eventually he decided, you know what, I'm going to write some variations on this melody.
And he was pretty much influenced by Haydn, not to mention an admirer of his works.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Brahms, as I say, he loved old music. He loved looking to older composers as models. And he had sort of a snarky sense of humor about it. He used to collect examples. He made a notebook of things that he considered mistakes that other composers had made.
Oh, wow.
So if you've ever taken some music theory classes, there's this rule, no parallel fifths. That's what they'll teach you in music theory. And so Brahms would go through and find older composers using parallel fifths. And then he'd write notes about them. And some of them are really funny. Some of them are interesting because he says, this is actually quite beautiful. Like, this actually works well. But other times he'll say, this is terrible. Or in one case he says, when the music is this bad, the fact that there are parallel fifths doesn't make it substantially worse.
It's not like he should be a music editor.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he did have some of that gene in him. And he eventually, during his time in Vienna, he sort of became a kind of taste maker in that sense as well. But in any case, he loved this Haydn tune. We now are pretty sure that Haydn didn't actually write it. We don't know for certain, but Brahms certainly thought he did. And again, I love this connection between him and Mendelssohn. You know, these two composers born in the same city who sort of go off in completely different, sort of live in two different worlds, sort of socioeconomically.
Mm-hmm.
And then they both sort of at various times in their lives find harmony music, and it inspires these two different works from them.
Oh.
And in Brahms' case, again, it may not have been by Haydn, but it was absolutely harmony music, music for wind ensemble. And Brahms decided to write, again, this set of variations. There are eight variations plus a finale. And one of the first pieces ever written for orchestra in the theme and variations form. That's not like a movement of a symphony or something like that, just a standalone work. And again, with everything with Brahms, it's his chance to sort of do what he wants, to show off his abilities as a composer. And again, as someone who probably felt a certain amount of insecurity about his own compositional upbringing and things like that, he always wanted to sort of show off his compositional skill. And the most skilled composer of all time is, of course, Bach. Bach,
yeah,
who could write all this really gnarly counterpoint and things like that. Like he could do sort of anything with notes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Bach is probably the most influential composer to Brahms. Brahms, like, if I can just do what Bach does, then I will be great.
Yep.
And so he likes to play a lot of the same sort of counterpoint games.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a big theory nerd, you love Brahms because you dive into these scores and like, oh, he's doing this cool canon thing where the melodies imitate, but this one's upside down and things like that. And so in the Haydn variations, you get certain amounts of that. And, you know, you can talk about it for days and use really big fancy words. You know, this is double invertible counterpoint at the 12th and things like that. But that's not really the effect, right? It's not what you notice. What you notice is that each of these eight variations in the finale has this really neat character to it. It just, it's essentially like eight miniature character pieces.
Oh,
each one
okay.
just has a slightly different mood.
Huh.
You know, the first variation has these sort of tumbling phrases that sort of cascade against each other.
Okay.
And the counterpoint game is that basically they switch halfway through, where the top voice does one thing and the bottom voice does another thing. And then when you get halfway through, they switch parts and then it turns it upside down and things like that. But as I say, it's not, that's not the way you think it. You just hear this, yada-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-da. This, again, this sort of lovely sort of cascading downward that happens.
Okay.
And again, each one has a slightly different vibe in that way. I think for me, I adore each one of them. You know, they're just like, you know, they're like your kids, right? Each one of them has their own sort of virtue to them. But I love the Vivace 2-4-1, the I think is a really popular one. And then the finale, which is it's a passacaglia, which basically means you take a bass line, usually a bass line, but you take this melody, a short snippet of a melody, and you repeat it again and again.
Okay.
But you change everything around it.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of a fractal because you get a set of variations within a set of variations, right, in this finale. And of course, because that little, because it's based on this tune, this little chunk of a tune that makes up the passacaglia melody is based on the original Haydn melody too. But that's such a glorious thing with this finale, where whenever you write a passacaglia, you get this, because you get this repeating melody, it's something that you can build and build and build and build, almost sort of bolero style, if you know.
Or just kind of builds into a crescendo, or it just comes into a climactic finish.
Exactly right. And that's exactly what happens in this finale. So you get this theme, this St. Anthony's Chorale, which is a lovely little tune, and then you get these sort of eight little character pieces, and then you get this last finale, which grows and grows until this awesome final climax. And of course, like any good set of variations, when you get to the climax, what are you going to hear? You're going to hear the theme again in its in its most glorious rendition. So it really is a spectacular thing. And I think the you know, we don't know, of course, that Haydn wrote anything about this, but it's even a little bit more mysterious than that, because the music says St. Anthony's Chorale.
Oh.
And but nobody can find a St. Anthony's chorale. Like nobody knows, because it's like nobody knows where the inspiration for that melody came from.
Oh, wow.
We don't know who wrote it or anything like that. So
a mystery piece.
Very much so. And so it's this really sort of great service that Brahms has done to sort of keep this originless tune sort of in the consciousness. So,
and here is the Haydn. Here are the Haydn Variations by Johannes Brahms. Let's listen in.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Donnelly, and this is KGPR Great Falls at 89.9 FM. Here in the studio with me is music director and conductor of the Great Falls Symphony, Grant Harville.
Hi, Matt.
And we're still talking about this upcoming concert, and we talked about Mendelssohn and Brahms being the sandwich, the bread of the concert. Now let's talk about the meat product.
Yeah, so in between those two pieces will be Prokofiev's first violin concerto. As I mentioned earlier in the hour, Megan Carls, who is one of our concertmasters, is going to be playing the solo part for us. And it's something that we have with our musicians a lot, is usually once or twice a year we'll feature one of our own in a concerto situation. And Megan and I were talking, and she's proposed a few things, and we sort of hit on the Prokofiev as a really good choice. That's one that she adores. She calls it a bucket list piece. And it is a really lovely work. It's sort of an oddly, it emerges at a very odd time. So Prokofiev is living in St. Petersburg, and it's 1917. This is the year of the revolution in Russia, and he writes a violin concerto. This is about as fraught a time as you can get in about just about anywhere, and somehow he's writing tons of music during this year that does not derail him in any way whatsoever. So this is one of the pieces that comes out of that situation. It doesn't get played right away. You can imagine that there are lots of reasons why concerts might get disrupted during that time. Gets premiered in Paris a few years later. But it's a really neat piece. It's kind of an inverted piece of what you expect from a concerto. Usually concertos are three movements long, three big sections, and they go fast, slow, fast. And this is sort of the opposite. The middle movement is the fast one. And the outer movements have this really sort of dreamy kind of mystical quality, especially with the way they end. They sort of evaporate up into the atmosphere, which is a really lovely kind of compositional sort of attitude to take towards the end of a piece. You know, usually you try to beat people over the head with the ending of your piece, but he lets this one sort of drift off into space, and it's a really lovely effect. But Prokofiev at the time, when he was in St. Petersburg, he was sort of the annoying kid of the new music scene there. Really sort of crunchy and slightly violent music that he tended to write, which really captivated some people and didn't quite sit right with some other people. And so in between these two sort of slightly dreamy outer movements, you get this scherzo, this this fast-moving, vivacissimo movement, it said, which is what lively, extra lively, I guess you would translate that as. And it's this scherzo, which is, it's got this sort of driving motoric rhythm underneath it. And it's a chance for the violinists to really show their stuff with their... to get around the fingerboard with their kinds of writing. And it's a really exciting movement. It's also, if you know Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, you'll hear some of this movement in the scherzo of the Fifth Symphony too. It's a style that Prokofiev would come back to several times. And it's actually, you can hear little hints of... a little bit of John Williams. You know, John Williams was famously influenced by many composers. Mean people will say that he stole shamelessly from them, but John Williams was not afraid to let the sounds that he heard come into his own music. And when you hear these other pieces, you sort of recognize that. So you can hear just hints of sort of the exciting music from E.T. in this early sort of Prokofiev scherzo style. It's a really sort of exciting, you can understand why John Williams would want to incorporate it. It's got this, again, a sort of driving excitement that underpins it. So I know for our recording, we're actually going to hear a movement, that second movement of the concerto. Thank you.
and also a little bit of closing thoughts. Where can people get ticket information to, or what time is the concert going to be?
Yeah, of course. So our concert will be at our usual time, Saturday night, 7:30, November 6th. That's a week from today. And it should be an exciting performance. Like all our performances this year, they're without intermission, just to sort of reduce the amount of mingling and things like that for safety reasons. It'll be a nice, a quick-hitting concert that people will really enjoy. And anybody who is looking for new information about it, the best place to go is gfsymphony.org. And that's where they can find out about the ticketing process and things like that.
Are people going to be watching this virtually like they did last year?
Yeah, so all of our concerts we're preparing videos for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like a theatrical release. If you want to see it in the theater, you'll get a few weeks head start on the home viewing crowd. I guess they're not doing that so much anymore. They're sort of releasing simultaneously now in a way that they never used to. But we'll have the concert, as I say, next Saturday. And then a few weeks after that, we'll have the video online and we'll make that available.
Great. Once again, I'm Matt Donnelly, and here in the studio with me is music director and conductor Grant Harville. Thanks for coming in, and we look forward to hearing more wonderful concerts.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.